We're the Nata Grande Boys. I'm Rodney Wood.
And I'm Kyle Jackson. Welcome to the Nata Grande Outdoors Podcast, where we
hunt it forward.
Welcome to the Nata Grande Outdoors Podcast. We have a very special guest today. It's going to be Colonel Griego, Bobby Griego, of the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. He is the head of the Field Operations Division.
Correct.
Welcome today. We really appreciate you coming in.
Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to be where you are, your background, how you grew up, all that stuff, because I'm sure it plays into where you are and what you're doing in the department.
Sure. I grew up in Captain, New Mexico, small community, rural community, ranching community. Grew up there hunting, fishing, trapping, and then went to school at New Mexico State in Las Cruces and got hired on with the game department in 1997. So I trained up in Farmington under a guy named Bob Culp, which kind of set the trajectory for my career as far as law enforcement goes.
So what I'm going to back up and kind of ask a few questions here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
What, I guess this is one of the main questions I think most game wardens probably get asked. Crap! Sorry about that, guys. That's my phone. Should put it on silent. You know us. We're not real prepared.
But yeah, we're bound to screw something up. Do you want to?
No, it's okay.
No, just keep going.
Anyway.
You don't want to look too professional.
Well, no, we're definitely not that.
I'm not sure we can look too professional. So, what made, I think the question that a lot of game wardens probably get asked is, what made you want to be a game warden?
Right. You know, in my family, hunting, fishing, and trapping was a pretty significant part of everything we did. And you know, I grew up in an era when, you know, the opening day of the first rifle deer season, they gave you the Monday or the Friday off of school because so many kids were going to be gone anyway. So they just,
God,
they
wish
just,
that was still the case.
Yeah,
right.
No doubt. So I always had a knack for hunting. Even as a kid, before I was hunting deer, you know, I was out there with my pellet gun or BB gun shooting birds or whatever else would let me near them. But probably as a teenager, late teenager, I kind of had a, I guess you'd say the rules meant something to me, even at that early age. Not that I didn't, do some shady things every now and again as a teenager, but, hunting rules and ethics, there was something about that just really struck me and I knew I wanted to be a game warden pretty early, probably by 16.
Very good. I think I've heard it said that the best game wardens are the ones that have done some shady stuff.
Sure.
They know how to catch
sure.
the bad guys,
yeah.
Right? So
I won't throw any of my accomplices under the bus, but yeah, we had some good times, but you know, never ever did anything that was wanton or wasteful, but yeah, we were kids, no doubt. Right.
Very good. So you started training what year was that?
I got hired in 1997. Went through the recruit school and the academy, so I was up in Farmington in 1998 under Bob Culp.
You were training under Bob the year that I started college.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's cool. And so take us from there, kind of. Well, for anybody out there who's maybe interested in being a game warden, take us through that process. Like, you know, what do they need to do, and then we'll come back to kind of your progression through game and fish.
Sure.
And how you got to where you are.
You know, any guy or gal out there that wants to be a wildlife law enforcement officer, you know, with New Mexico, it used to be that we required a wildlife degree or biology degree, range science. Now we've expanded that to criminal justice and some other degrees. really, I believe that the wildlife range is still a significant part of it, but the key is a true love of hunting, fishing, or trapping, or all the above. It takes a little more than just liking the outdoors. You've got to have a passion for the resource and wanting to protect it. Because today's society, to be in law enforcement is not the greatest time to be in law enforcement across the nation, getting scrutinized pretty hard. And law enforcement has always been scrutinized, but it seems like the public support has gone away in some instances. In some areas, it's as strong as it ever was, but when people see it across the news nationally, it makes a young guy or gal think twice about, do I want to put myself through something like that? Mm-hmm. But, you know, having that strong base of the outdoors and wildlife, I think there's been instances where we've had some individuals who they didn't hunt, fish, or trap, but they had a significant love of the resource. And if they're willing to put the work in, you know, I think a guy can catch up, get behind the curve, or get ahead of the curve eventually, but it takes significant effort.
And I think we have an idea because we are, you know, hunters, fishers, right. Trappers. We have that passion. We know that those people are oftentimes the best conservationists, the ones who are doing the most for the resource. But we also, you know, our attempt with this podcast is to reach people who are not part of this hunting community and trying to get them to come into this hunting mm-hmm. community. Explain why someone who hunts, fishes, or traps is a good fit for that, and why they tend to kind of, I guess, you know, probably excel or do better in mm-hmm. that position versus like a, let's say, biologist or something.
Sure. You know, I think it's first off a love and respect for the activity of hunting, fishing, and trapping, but more so as a conservation officer or game warden, it can boil down as simple to if you've been a hunter or trapper, and on this particular day you're waking up to patrol and the wind is blowing, well, a guy that's been a hunter knows that if most of those hunters are going to be down in the canyons where that wildlife is during that type of mm-hmm. of storm, and rather than wasting their time out on the flats, just simple things like that, or it's raining, or it's evening, or certain times of year during the rut, a hunter's going to know where the wildlife is, and in turn where our hunters are going to be to make those contacts. Same thing with certain times of the year where spotlighting might be more prevalent than others, because knowing the wildlife and knowing where they will be will sure save a guy a lot of miles of just wasting their time versus mm-hmm. being effective. So
good. So take us through, I guess, your experiences as a game warden and how it led you to where you're at.
Sure. You know, I was a game warden that I probably, or without a doubt, I've always focused a little more on my law enforcement effort. You know, game wardens or conservation officers, we talk about the conservation officer concept, and that's essential. It's important, but that entails, you know, your law enforcement effort, your public affairs, your wildlife management, all of that put together. And even though I enjoy paying attention to the habitat and the wildlife management aspect of it, I had a tendency to really, I enjoyed the law enforcement aspect of it. And that's where I put probably more effort. I would get a little frustrated as a younger officer when I'd looked at some habitat and would start working with the other agencies, the federal agencies, and the bureaucracy behind that would frustrate me. If I looked at some country and thought, you know, we need to really thin this country out and pinyon-juniper encroachment, and everyone agreed, and they said, well, after we do NEPA and all of that, you know, we'll get to it in about 8 years.
It's a long process. Yeah, it tends to be a long process.
So that tended to frustrate me, and although I did it, I didn't focus as much on that because of the bureaucracy end of that. And I focus more on my law enforcement effort and my public affairs or public relations. As a game warden, it's essential that you get to know your community and you make contacts with all the community, but especially those individuals that live out of town. You know, those ranchers that are out there, you've got to have a good relationship with them because they're on the ground as much or more than we are. They're going to see things, and if you don't have a relationship, they're not going to take the time out of their day to make the call to let you know.
Well, and to that point, you have how many officers statewide?
We have about 75 to 80 officers on the ground out in the field.
And give us a comparison for somebody who doesn't realize, you know, the numbers versus the scope of the landscape in New Mexico. Kind of give us an idea of an officer per how many square miles.
It's pretty significant. Our average district, a district being the geographical area that each officer is responsible for, is around 2,000 square miles. So pretty significant.
Very significant because you look at some of those states back east that are real, you know, small states like Rhode Island, you know, New Hampshire. They oftentimes have two game wardens to a county, and a county is not even as big as some of the districts here in New Mexico.
Yeah, you know, I spent my first district was the reserve district there in Catron County, and I was there for 8 years, and amazingly, I went back a few times to go help with hunts, and even after being there 8 years, I still found roads that I'd never been completely through. You're just not going to cover it all, and being effective it's pretty difficult when you've got that much country.
Well, and like you were talking about, that's one of the things another thing that we really advocate for is we've lost a lot of the public hunter and the private landowner. Seems like there's a... Rodney keeps telling me, just speak up, Rodney. Quit giving me the eye. Sorry about that. I tend to slam my fist on the...
The thumping you keep hearing is me.
I'll try and minimize that. There seems to be a divide, and it's in my mind, or in my experience, it has grown, I think, over the past 10, 15 years or more between private landowners and the public hunters. Whereas I remember when I was a kid, even though I didn't do as much hunting as I do now, it seemed like it was a lot easier to get onto some of these places to go hunt.
Sure.
And the relationship you're talking about between the officers in the community and the landowners is also pretty key in that, I would think.
Without a doubt. You know, again, back to growing up, I can remember deer hunting or elk hunting, and we were going to hunt on what my dad used to call a school section, which was state land. Mm-hmm. And we would always call the landowner or the lessee to say, hey, we're going to be hunting this state land. And at the time, I didn't think twice about it till later on as an adult, thinking, you know, even back then we had, or my dad had the respect for that rancher, that lessee, to give him, hey, just a heads up, even though it may not be public land, but it's dang sure not private, and we had every right to be on there hunting, mm-hmm. Still giving them the heads up, hey, we're going to be out here. So to this day, there's times I'll go coyote hunting and call the rancher, hey, heads up, I'm going to be out there doing some calling, and because of that. And that's important to build those relationships. You know, over time, if you just go out and look on any private land or lease land and see the amount of bullet holes in windmill fins or signs, that plays that has an impact on whether landowners are going to let you on their property. And it may not be you. It might have been an occurrence that happened 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and that was enough that turned that landowner off that, you know, it's just not worth it to have a public hunter on there.
Yeah. We've talked about that a lot here on this podcast, is the relationship between public landowners and private landowners.
Sure.
And there is a divide and there is a fight going on between the two factions for those exact reasons. You know, I remember same thing as a young man. We used to quail hunt out there in Three Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing. We would always call them and tell them, hey, we're coming out and we're going to go quail hunt. And it was all BLM and state. And they had the leases. And, yeah, we had the legal right to be there, but we also had the respect to call them and say, hey, we're going to be out there. And they had windmill tanks out there on that state land. And when we drive by, we would look, and there would be dove and quail feathers and carcasses in the tanks.
Right.
And it's no wonder that these landowners don't want public hunters out there.
Well, it's not just then. It's now. We went out back in the fall to take Adrian and Emily shooting to the range to get ready for their hunts, and went out west of Albuquerque out there to some BLM land. The BLM had put up some really nice kiosks and thing like that with mm-hmm. maps of the area and bullet holes all through
yeah.
it. And,
yeah.
And we as public landowners don't do a good job of respecting, you know, we always exert the idea that we are public landowners, we have a right to be there, but you know,
we also have a responsibility
to take care of that property, and especially the, you know, if we're gonna try and build those relationships with private landowners, you've got to have that respect because that's their livelihood.
Sure, but I think it's important to recognize also that, you know, the vast majority of our sportsmen are pretty honest, ethical individuals that would never do something like that.
Oh, agree.
It's a few bad apples that ruin it for everybody.
Yeah, yes.
I agree.
And
that's with a lot of things in life.
Sure.
Not just hunting, but...
And, you know, probably even more so than a bullet hole through a windmill fin, which, you know, one or two is having zero impact. It's, I think, more so what landowners get frustrated, and anyone that's been in the ag industry that's had to gather a pasture
gates left
over and over again because someone didn't close a gate.
I will throw my hand up because I've had to do that.
If it's open, leave it open. If it's shut, leave it shut.
And I think that's what happens more often than criminal damage. Mm-hmm. It's just someone doesn't understand the significance of closing a gate.
Well, it's just a gate to them. It's just something that they got to go through, and it's so much easier just to leave it open because, I may come back out this
right.
way. They don't understand the workings of, yeah, I got cattle in this
right.
in this pasture, and I need to keep them separate from this pasture because I got bulls in this pasture. They
yeah.
just don't understand
yeah.
that.
Or no, anyone that's gathered yearlings in a cedar-covered pasture and understands the effort that goes into getting those knot heads going in one direction, much less having to redo that three or four times.
Because you miss cattle or
yeah.
whatever else. Yeah.
That can get pretty frustrating on anybody. And I think that's an important aspect of, I think, as you know, the game department in conjunction with the ag industry, educating our sportsmen and people in general, hikers, dog walkers, whatever the case may be, the importance of a simple, that those of us that grew up in rural America, you learn that by 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Close the gate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how fast you're going to be coming back through it. Close it.
Mm-hmm.
And something simple like that could pay dividends for 20 years into the future.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Went on a little bit of squirrel. a rabbit chase there. Back to kind of your career as a game warden. How did you get to where you're at? What led you to say, I'm gonna, because you were in Magdalena for quite a while.
Yep,
right?
Yep. Again, I think it goes back to my focus, my training officer. You know, I give him a lot of credit. He was a dang good game warden. Really, he focused on law enforcement. He was good at it, and in turn, that helped me. Even though he was well-rounded and he did a lot of habitat and wildlife work, that love of the law enforcement side of it really set the trajectory for my career, because as I got to reserve, back in those days, we only had 4 training officers in the whole state. So those 4 guys trained all the new recruits. And when I had about 3 years on, I was making a pretty good name for myself there in reserve, making some pretty good cases. Fortunate or unfortunate, I guess, the officer that was there before me was did not have or did not seem to have the same passion. So those first 2 years, I looked real good because cases were just falling out of the sky. the bad guys there had no fear of the game department. So some of it was easier than others. But because of that, I was making a pretty good name for myself, and I applied. One of those field training officer jobs came open, and I was fortunate enough to get it, even with 3 or 4 years on at the time. And back to that training officer, he was also teaching our Chapter 17, which is our law portion, to our recruits in our recruit school. So he brought me in on that to help him teach that. So between those 2 things, I was able to become a training officer and start working with recruits, which helps an officer out a lot, because new officers, recruit officers, will ask the craziest questions. They make you think. And just like any child, they will ask you why. Okay, you said that, but why? What's the reason we're doing this? And it makes you better. So I got to be a training officer, did that, and then I promoted to sergeant with about 8 years. In those days, again, too, you just weren't going to become a sergeant until you had about 10 years on. It didn't happen. We had fewer sergeants then, and guys tended to stay in those positions. To this day, I still think that's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, position in the agency, is that sergeant's position, because you have enough authority to kind of do things your way in your supervisory district. You can mold your officers and really empower your officers and get them excited about your program. You know, the department, without a doubt, has the sideboards that we've set forward, but those sergeants are the buy-off. If your sergeants aren't bought off on the program, their officers aren't going to be bought off on the program, and then you get nowhere. So that sergeant position is fantastic, because you're out in the field still. You get a little bump in pay, but you get to do things kind of your way. And the importance of being out there in the field, game warden or any law enforcement, I think, across the nation, you ask any officer, they'll tell you what's the greatest thing about being a police officer, a game warden, a firefighter. They're going to all tell you it's the camaraderie. It's being there and being able to trust those individuals that are with you. And like anything, till you've been in a situation that was pretty sketchy, I mean legitimately scary, mm-hmm. When you come out the other end of that, those officers that were with you that helped you get through that, whether it was a pretty hairy situation where guns were drawn, or a sketchy arrest warrant where this individual is pretty dangerous, when you come out the other end of those, you have a whole new respect for those people that are around you. So that was pretty significant. And then Even with the amount of officers that come in and out of your house that stay the night, and your spouses are cooking dinners for four and five guys, and those were some of the best times, you know, that to this day my wife still talks about. That was some of the funnest times, with is having just different officers at different days, sometimes two or three times a week. It was fantastic.
Yeah. I guess.
Well, we haven't finished your question.
We haven't.
So, as I became a sergeant, I an FTO, and then promoted to sergeant, and did that for another 8 years. I was there in Magdalena, but still over that same part of the world, Southwest, the Gila. I did that for 8 years and got to mold those officers. And we had a new director come in, and he kind of changed, not kind of, he without a doubt changed the whole perspective of the agency and the reorganization of our law enforcement, that was the most impactful on the agency, I think, where we, before then, we had area chiefs. You kind of had the four areas that did it their way, according to that chief. And when this new director came in, Jim Lane, he reorganized the department where it was straight line chain of command for law enforcement, and created that colonel position. And reality is, if it had not been for him and his vision and what he wanted for the department, I probably would not have been in this position, because I was a sergeant at the time, so technically, or literally, I jumped lieutenant, captain, major to colonel, from a sergeant. And it was because of his vision of what he wanted conservation law enforcement to look like in New Mexico. And that's how I got in this position and have been here for 6 years now.
And so that's an interesting, kind of brings up another interesting topic is, you're in a pretty high position as a colonel of field operations. You have a lot of that working in, inner working knowledge of the department and how all that works. When you look through the history of the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, and I've released some historical articles, and I will continue to do that about Game and Fish and things like that, but sometimes it kind of goes through these cycles where a lot of stuff is dictated out of Santa Fe, and then you see through history where that power is pushed out to the area offices, and so kind of explain how that works and how the whole kind of system works. I know everybody kind of knows that we have a game commission, but a lot of people don't know how that game commission is put in place. They don't know the relationship of the director to the game commission, and then each of the divisions within the department, how all that works together.
Right.
I don't know if you can shed a little bit of light on that. I know, before I started looking into it, it didn't make any sense to me, so.
Probably there's a lot of moving parts there, but the way it works is really the governor appoints seven commissioners, game commissioners in New Mexico. We have seven commissioners that are supposed to be from across New Mexico, across the entire state, and represent different segments of New Mexico. With that, the commission hires a director or cabinet secretary over the agency. That director acts as their secretary. So a lot of people think that, well, the director is the ultimate authority over the game department. And reality is there's still two layers that individual's got to work with and coexist with the commission, who sets the standard or the direction for that director, And then you've also got the governor and the governor's office, you know, that has input into the direction. Sure.
Whatever they want to do.
And with field operations, you know, then there's a deputy director under that director, and then the colonel position. So really, what on the law enforcement aspect of it, you know, the law is what the law is. We can't deviate from that. No one can say don't do this or don't do that as far as what the law says and what the Constitution says. But they give us direction on kind of what they'd like us to focus on. And as the colonel, my job is to ensure that we have enough officers, enough the proper equipment, the proper training, and that I kind of try and set the direction for how we're going to move forward, whether it be focusing on community policing and really focusing on the egregious violations, those violations that are truly hurting the resource, and disseminating that down as to all the way down to the field troop and just really sideboards. We know that in any agency, your younger officers are going to be your hard chargers. They're going to write a lot of citations, do great work, but they make young mistakes. It's not about that. It's about changing the culture or setting the culture of the agency, that recognizing all the way down to those young officers that, you know, focus on those egregious violations. If you find a kid or someone that it's an honest mistake, maybe it's something as simple as fishing without a license. It's the whole goal on conservation law enforcement is voluntary compliance. What are we going to get the most voluntary compliance from? Because there are so few of us, we're not going to catch every violation. So setting the culture so that when that officer comes across a situation like a 17-year-old kid fishing without a license, is it a violation? Yes. But is issuing that individual a citation the best solution for that circumstance? Is something like giving them, educating them about the importance of the license and telling them, hey, go get a license, and then you're good? Or maybe even allowing them to finish the day, but say, you better get a license next time I see you. Does that change the trajectory of that individual's life, where maybe they want to become a game warden, or maybe they just become
aware?
Yeah, more aware, and become a lawful sportsman from there forward because they were given a break. So using common sense, and the Game Commission, again, they're there to adopt rules and regulations that we must enforce. And sometimes they're spot on with what they do. Sometimes we don't completely agree. And my job is to talk to them and give them the reality of it might just be words on paper to some individuals, but we're the division that's going to have to look someone in the eye and enforce that rule.
Yeah.
And the sillier those rules are, the harder it is for our officers in the field to do their job.
So I guess
on a sidebar, you real quick, you were talking about, you know, fishing and what you should do when you catch that person. Personal experience here, Kyle knows me and my fishing history.
He's shady.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I used to be.
You used to be.
But it's perspective.
We've talked about it.
Perspective and education is everything.
Sure.
You know, I always, you know, I bought my fishing license and I'm catching this fish and I'm going to eat these fish. But what I never really thought of is how those fish got there and what it cost to get them there. And, you know, so now it's not like I was going out and catching 100 fish and taking them home or anything, but you know, the rule was four and I'd get five or six. And then it wasn't until Kyle explained to me what it cost per fish to put them in the water then you kind of stop and you think, all right.
Well, and a lot of people haven't thought about that.
No.
You know, they don't think about that we have enough anglers in New Mexico and who visit New Mexico that most of our fisheries can't, and tell me if I'm wrong here, most of our fisheries can't function naturally.
Right.
We have to supplement, that's why we have the hatcheries to give, you know, put fish in and that type of thing.
Well, yeah, and especially, you're talking about like a lake like Grindstone. That place gets hammered, especially now with Bonita down, which is a good question for you. I'll ask in a minute. But, you know, right now, Grindstones and Alto Lake are the only things around there in Ruidoso other than the Rio Ruidoso. And I know they've done some good work on creating some fisheries on the Rio Ruidoso and working with some private landowners to get access to some places in there. But that place gets hammered. So if you weren't putting fish in there...
Well, it's the same way with the Cimarron River up there. You know, between Cimarron and Eagle Nest, that you know, Eagle Nest Lake feeds the Cimarron River in the wintertime. That pretty much gets shut off because they're not releasing any irrigation water down that river. And there's a few holes where maybe some fish, if it's not a real bad winter, maybe some fish can winter over. But pretty much every fish that the department puts in that river gets taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. I mean, that's a good example of that.
Yeah, and you got to start thinking like that and be a little bit less selfish. And we talk about that on our podcast a lot, is not being selfish. And, you know, here I was taking 5 or 6 fish when the limit is 4, and that takes away from other people. And y'all can only put so many fish in there because of the cost. And unless you are able to wrap your mind around those types of things.
Well, it also plays into the fact, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit more, Colonel, that the department does not take any general fund money.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that is sportsman's dollars, whether it's license fee, even our federal aid is matching funds based on firearms, ammunition, and other equipment for hunting, fishing.
Pittman Robertson, exactly. Dingle Johnson.
Yeah.
It's a pay-to-play system.
For that one.
You know, with our fisheries, you're absolutely right. It costs significant amounts of money to get those fish from eggs or fry to a catchable size. So on the fishery side, they work it to where we want to stock catchable fish. You don't want to put a bunch of little ones in there, and it would be great to put a bunch of big ones in there. But it's playing that law of averages of what does it cost us to grow a bunch of 16-inch trout versus a bunch of 12-inch trout.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be another year or two or three of feeding those fish to get them to that trophy size. So playing, okay, if we put 12-inch fish, they're still catchable, they're eatable, and playing that. And there's only so many fish that you can put into a system where they can continue to thrive for those few months, 6 months, versus, okay, we're going to put 40,000 fish in this lake.
And in addition to that, those waters like the Cimarron River where we know we're just putting them in to be caught versus some of those larger fisheries that we're putting them in to sustain or grow those
populations. Yeah. Big difference.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into managing that.
Coming back to the, you know, the department and the Game Commission and all those moving parts, I guess one question that might be helpful to the public out there, because there's on social media you always see people asking questions. Well, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Or why was the department doing this? There's several divisions within the department, and each of those divisions kind of has their directive and mm-hmm. the way that, and they each have a chief and the way that they're going to go. So I guess, what's your vision for field operations, and how does that fit within the greater department mission and yeah, I don't know how to say it other than that, I guess.
You know, for field ops or the department in general, you know, I think what's important is that we continue to manage our wildlife resources where we can continue to increase opportunity for our sportsmen. Those individuals are the ones paying our bills, and they have an expectation that we're professional and continue to make New Mexico a keystone area for hunting, fishing, and trapping. And that's just a segment of it. We've got parts of the state that we need to continue to ensure that the elk in the Gila or Valle Vidal remain premier. We've got some of the best antelope hunting, bar none, in the world, or at least in North America, where we've got antelope.
Yeah, it's the only place. It is the world, because that's the only place we've got antelope. So.
But we've got some of the best antelope hunting in the world. You compare our antelope as far as size to Wyoming, it's not even comparable. So we need to ensure that we continue to manage those species and keep that quality up. Now, we've got other aspects where there are opportunity. We just need to ensure that we continue to have wildlife, continue to have deer. It'd be great to have deer like we did in the late 60s and 70s, but with that is a lot of things out of our control, like rain. I think there's different arguments, too, as to what the landscape looked like in the 50s, 60s, and 70s compared to now. I think some of it has to do with the type of livestock we have out there. I think sheep, for some reason, they graze differently. We had significant amount of predator control, and we're coming off of pretty good moisture that our deer population was up in those days. And will we ever get back to that? I don't know. But that's an aspect of it. We've got other divisions that we're focusing on, endangered species and non-game. And right now, politically, that's a hot button in that a lot of our citizens are saying, hey, we need to be putting more effort into this non-game and non-traditional, where the non-hook and bullet individuals, because our wildlife belongs to all of our citizens, and it's not just our game animals. And I think the agency has done pretty well with that. We're just not as vocal about it. And I think, again, that gets back on the game department, where we need to start educating the public on what the entire agency does, because we are focusing on those endangered species. One that got credit and got some news out there was our desert bighorn sheep. Mm-hmm. What we did to that program as an agency, and brought it back from being at those low numbers to we're hunting them again. We've got a good population, but that's something we hunt. We're doing that with some of the non-game also, or a lot of the non-game. We're just not vocal about it, and we need to get better at expressing the accomplishments of those divisions also.
Well, I think the other thing that would probably be beneficial to the department is to get better about a lot of the education, like you were talking about, in helping people to understand that the people paying for and buying hunting, trapping, and fishing licenses are the ones that are paying for that, and everybody is benefiting.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you want to see those endangered species come off the list, if you want, you should be getting into hunting, right, trapping, and fishing, because that's what pays for it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's a system that a lot of people, and we've talked about this a lot on here too, that's a system that most people are vastly unaware of. All hunting and fishing dollars come from the sale of licenses, tags, applications, and stuff like that, and is matched by Pittman Robertson. And Pittman Robertson is excise taxes for firearms, bullets, and then boats, fishing equipment, stuff like that. But all of that money comes from us, comes from those people that are exercising that right. And the non-hunters out there, if you want to help, buy a hunting license. You don't have to go hunting, but buy a hunting license.
Right. And wildlife management in general, it's not rocket science. But what makes it difficult is you put in the human aspect to it. You know, it's not about just continuing to grow animals, because there's a carrying capacity of what the habitat can support, but reality is there's a social carrying capacity is what we deal with mostly. You know, could we grow more elk? Absolutely. But socially, there's a segment that says we want to see more elk. There's another segment that says, okay, we have too many elk because of damage to fence, damage to crops, whatever the case may be. So it's weighing all of
that. Highway accidents, all kinds of stuff.
There's all of that that goes into it. And that's what makes it difficult. It's the human aspect. Everyone likes to see deer in their yard until they start eating all the trees and flowers.
How much, so you're talking about the different departments and you know, the commission and the law enforcement agency portion of it. How much influence does the law enforcement officers have on the rules and regs and how things are set up?
You know, that's one thing where I personally am trying to be better about including our officers from the ground up. A significant portion across the nation for wildlife agencies is recruiting people into the sport of hunting, fishing, and trapping, or just outdoor stuff. So our officers are the most significant portion of getting people into the program, because they are the face of the agency. And because they're the face of the agency and they're the boots on the ground, they're the ones enforcing these laws, I try to include all of our officers when we're developing rules. Now, do they have as much say when the commission decides to do something? Not so much. But a lot of the rules that we present are with input of our officers from day one. So they do have a significant input. They just don't have the final say, which, you know, what comes out the other end might be 180 degrees from what that game warden in reserve wanted. But they did have input in the process.
So that's also something for people to understand, though, is that what one single officer, one single person in one part of the state wants may not weigh out against those social issues, against the greater wildlife management direction that's, you know, being taken by the Wildlife Management Division, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All that weighs in. I think that's one of the biggest things that many people probably don't understand, is just the complexities of the agency and everything that has to happen in order for these rules to be made and passed, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, again, elk, for example, what a rule that would work great in the Gila may not work so well in Clayton. And we can't have rules. We can't have 22 different rules for elk in the state. We typically try and have a rule that applies the best coverage across the whole state.
Yeah.
So those individual interests, sometimes it seems like we're going against them, but it's not. It's what works best for the entire state and all the individuals and all the different pieces. That's what makes it difficult.
Yeah. We got some questions that we had some of our listeners send in. I'll start with one. David King asked, and this kind of ties into what you're saying. He was asking, what was the thinking behind making Unit 34 elk hunts all either sex hunts this year? Typically, they're either mature bull or antlerless, but this year in Unit 34, they're all either sex.
Right. You know, a lot of that with 34 is that's one of those elk populations that we've got a segment that's saying, hey, we want to see the quality's getting better. Let's continue to make it better. Let's reduce the amount of tags. Let's protect those big bulls. But we've got another segment that's saying, okay, we got way too many elk here. Through all our surveys It's got one of the highest cow-to-calf ratios and bull-to-cow ratios in the state. So it's one of those that we're trying to reduce that herd while still maintaining as much of the quality as we can. And that's where that came from, is allowing an individual, rather than having to just shoot a mature bull, they have the opportunity to kill any elk. And, you know, a lot of our sportsmen that put in for those hunts, if they're out there for a mature bull, they're probably going to go home empty-handed if they don't get an opportunity at a mature bull. But it gives them the option of, on that last day or two, if they want to just take home some meat, rather than shoot that little 3x3 that happened to come in, they can take a cow and still protect some of that mature bull age class, but get some meat.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. Really good question. Another question we had come in that I guess kind of ties into some of this is, and it's a question that we wanted to kind of talk with you a little bit about, is some of the new laws that are going to take effect this hunting season. I know there's been a change to some of the manner and method.
Mm-hmm.
One specific question that came in was, what was the reason for changing the caliber for big game? I know when Rodney first saw it.
Who asked that?
That was
Lamar
Shaw asked that. But when Rodney first saw that, I know he was like 22, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was the question that Lamar wanted to see if you could answer, is what are the reasonings for? I guess let's talk about that one first, and then a little bit about some of the rule changes in general.
You know, manner and method in that one in particular, that specific rule, what we looked at when we were revamping manner and method, and this was some of my direction, in that what we're trying to do is simplify the rules that are out there for our sportsmen. Trying to not over-regulate our sportsmen.
Which is awesome.
Right.
And I think hopefully this will get out there and people will understand that, because that's something that we absolutely agree with, is let's make it easier for people to hunt.
Yeah. You know, and the way it was is we had certain species like elk and oryx, for example, that it had to be a 24 caliber or larger, and the others were a 22 caliber or larger, and it's center fire, not rim fire. The vast majority of our elk hunters, I would say, are out there with 30 caliber or larger.
Mm-hmm.
You'd run into occasional a 243 out there, which is fine if you get a well-placed shot and you know your capabilities. You can kill elk with a 243. I've seen it done multiple times.
Yeah, there's a whole bag of snakes there getting into calibers and what's
sure,
the best.
Right. So. We also had Barbary sheep that for years, it's always been, it was one of those species that was a 22 caliber or larger. Well, anyone who's been around Barbary sheep knows that Barbary sheep are one of the hardest animals to get knocked down on the ground.
Yeah.
But we were not running into individuals hunting with a 243 or a 22-250. They were out there with 30 caliber type weapons.
Yeah.
And we just were not running into individuals hunting with those small. So again, to simplify and not over-regulate, what we're saying is that you can use any center fire that you feel comfortable with, knowing that our sportsmen, they know what they need to be using.
Yeah.
We're not running into those violations. And we think it's one of those that our sportsmen are going to self-regulate. They know what they mm-hmm. what the weapon type that they need to be, or the caliber that they need to be effective and make a humane shot.
Yeah, and that speaks to, you know, we just did a podcast on ethics, laws, and morals, mm-hmm. and all the gray areas in between.
Yeah,
and that speaks to you know, what we were talking about before, is that the vast majority of the sportsmen out there are true conservationists, are doing it for the right reason, and are going to do the right thing.
Yeah. It's no different than taking a 100-yard shot with a bow. Yeah. Right? You're not going to take that shot if, or you shouldn't take that shot if you're not sure that you can make that shot.
Right. I mean,
if you have a question about whether or not you can make the shot, you shouldn't take the shot. So it's the same thing with a 22 caliber. If you don't think that you can take that animal with that, don't do it. Okay. You know, who's the government to tell us what we can and can't do? Because you
if there's a kid out there that they want to go elk hunting, but they're recoil shy or whatever the case may be, but they feel really comfortable with that 22-250, and that gets that kid out there on that cow hunt, and they keep it within 100 yards, you can get it done. Again, but we're still not seeing that. We're still seeing most of those kids with muzzle brakes and stuff that's out there now. You know, my boys, they shoot a 270 short mag and have been since they were probably 12 years old. I got a muzzle brake on it. It has almost no recoil.
Yeah.
And that's what they use.
Yeah.
But it was, again, we're trying to simplify and not over-regulate our sportsmen. And if we get used to, in our own state, we look at our big game rules proclamation or rule information booklet. We know it by heart. We know all the rules. But try getting someone else's proclamation from another state and look at all the rules.
Oh, yeah.
It's so confusing. So that's what we're trying to do is any of those laws that were out there that we're not running into those violations, just trying to do away with them to simplify the whole system.
Well, I think that's kind of what happened with the proclamation this year, right? Did you have any say in how that was, how the new proclamation was kind of set up? Because it's vastly different from the way it was in the past.
Yeah, but I love it.
Yeah, what we did is it was primarily your brother, Captain Ty Jackson, that did the bulk work of that. But yeah, I was hand in hand with him with a lot of his ideas. And again, that whole process was to simplify it and make it easier for our hunter when they're looking at that all the information they need is right there at hand.
And it's so funny because before we started this podcast, we were kind of talking about the question about calibers, and you said something that, you know, you're trying to make it easier for people to do stuff, and then you have certain people who say, no, we want a regulation type of thing.
Right.
I think it's almost that visceral human reaction of, it's new, so I don't like it, because the first time, you know, I can't remember who it was, but I was with somebody when those proclamations first came out, and they looked at it, and they go, why'd they change it? It was just fine. And you get to looking at it, you're like, it is so much easier than the old way.
I love it. I mean, it really makes it nice, because you just go to the unit, and everything's right there. You don't have to flip to three different sections to look at the same unit.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that hunt by weapon choice, but there's probably more people that hunt by unit.
Yeah.
And they want to look at that unit and have their options right there in front of
them. Well, if you were looking at different options and different GMUs, you had to go, okay, what's the dates over here? And then what's the dates over here? And then you had to go to a different section if you wanted to change weapon types. Mm-hmm. And oh man, it was
just even simpler is when we took the proclamation from the size it was and made it the smaller. And that was the whole reason behind that was, again, so guys could carry them a little easier, didn't have this big book compared to the smaller book.
Fits in your backpack real nice.
We had a lot of complaints that, well, now I can't read it. It's too small. Well, the print size did not change. it was no different, but just
the size. Just that change.
It was different, and we had people complain about it. And you know, now people have gotten used to it. But again, we're just trying to make it easier for our hunters. What the last thing we want is violations that our officers are coming across that are because of confusion. Because that's our fault. If we've got confusing laws, or you've got so many laws out there that you're either, A, pushing people away because they look at it and go, you know what, I'm not sure I can do this and stay legal just because by mistake, or you have laws that are so confusing that they just don't know. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
All right. So I guess kind of staying in the same realm of new laws and things like that, there's a legislative session going that will end here pretty shortly. But we had a listener pose the question about some of the proposed laws that are going through, and if they're passed, how they're going to affect Game and Fish and how your officers do business, particularly he mentioned the House Bill 8, Senate Bill 8, which is the quote-unquote universal background checks, mm-hmm. And then also some of those other Second Amendment laws.
Sure.
And of course, you know, after that we can probably touch on some of the stuff that will obviously affect Game and Fish.
Mm-hmm. Really, the bill that the governor signed into law yesterday will have really no effect on our business. You know, requiring individuals to do a background check on licensed sales. You know, no matter where an individual stands on that, as far as our business and going on with hunting, it'll have no effect. We don't make a habit of, when we check our hunters in the field and for some reason have their firearm in our hands, we're not writing down serial numbers off of our sportsmen's firearms and checking them in any way. You know, if we have a significant case where we're seizing firearms, we will check those for stolen. But on a day-in, day-out basis of handling firearms, we're not writing down that information and nor checking if they're registered or not.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as our business goes, it'll have almost no impact.
Okay. I guess... So there's several bills going through that have, well, at least that we've been following, that seem to have some momentum. I know one that you're probably very cognizant about and keeping an eye on is the anti-traffic bill.
Sure.
What's that looking like, and what is that going to look like? If passed, what's that going to look like for the department, how the department does business?
Right. You know, that bill, if passed, we would be the first state in the nation to do an all-out ban of trapping on public land, which obviously we are opposed to. We recognize trapping as a significant wildlife management tool.
Well, it's not just us. I mean, there's several premier wildlife professional agencies, AFWA, things like that, who have put out that information that's a very viable,
sure,
and needed management tool, correct?
Without a doubt. You know, WAFWA, which is the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies and the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies have come out in support of regulated trapping. The Wildlife Society, which is the premier wildlife biologist, wildlife management organization, has come out in support of regulated trapping. The top veterinary organization in the nation has come out in support of regulated trapping. Again, that's another one of those with a lot of misinformation being thrown around. I think, and maybe it's playing into their side of, a lot of people don't understand trapping, and when they think of traps, they think of the big tooth jaw trap that you see on Looney Tunes.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, with BMP's best management practices and the millions of dollars that have put into research on ensuring that today's technology, today's traps are effective, humane, that they're reducing as much injury as possible or no injury, and that's significant. And you know, all the photographs that go around the internet and the talk of these bone crushing mechanisms, the reality is traps are designed to simply hold the animal by the foot until the trapper gets there. And there are, those animals are not being trapped and left there to die, and then somehow comes along the trapper and waiting for those animals to die before he harvests them. They're being checked every day. A lot of those animals are not in a trap for more than 4 to 6 hours. And yeah, there are extreme cases where, which are being highlighted, but those are, that's illegal to do.
Well, that's just like you talked about it. You know, most of the people out there are doing it correct. What gets highlighted as a bad apple.
Few bad apples, yeah.
Without a doubt,
yeah.
You know,
and that's not doing, you know, it doesn't do anybody good. But again, it's that's what people focus on.
Sure.
Yeah.
And our trappers are, for the most part, very law-abiding. Some of our most staunch sportsmen are our trappers. And, you know, when you go through violation rates, our average violation rate for our anglers is in that 8 to 10% range. Our average violation rate for our hunters in general is about 3 to 5%. Our average violation rate on our trappers is about 1%. But they do get highlighted when those violations occur. And we do our best to prosecute those individuals because they are harming, they're putting bad information, a bad light on our legal trappers. And it is highly regulated. So again, a lot of misinformation being put out there. If traps were designed to break bones and crush limbs and chop legs off, well, that would not be effective. We need that animal to be there, unharmed when the trapper gets there to harvest that individual.
We got some cool video. We did a trapping podcast not too long ago, and we got some cool video that we've yet to put out.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if you're a first time listener, I would refer you back to the trapping podcast that we've done with my brother Ty, and the just a sheer amount of good information that he provided us with. And we will put out those videos where he actually put
We got a video of him putting his hand in the trap and it going off on his
hand. Your boys are the same. Your boys have been trapping since they're how young?
Oh yeah, since they were probably 5 years old, and both of them have caught in a finger a time or two, you know, they still have all their fingers. None of them were broken, but it is truly, you know. It's pretty neat to when you're a trapper and you go out there and you look at this vast landscape and you're looking at and you're wanting to take all of those acres and you're needing an animal. You need to place a trap in a spot where that 2-inch circle or 3-inch circle, that's where you need that animal to step. And you get pretty in tune with nature and your surroundings to do that.
Yeah.
Again, you know, this bill is it's titled, you know, public safety. The reality is, again, it's that 2-inch circle. If a human steps on it, even a child, their foot is going to span that trap, or it's going to be on a jaw. It's not going to clamp down on a foot.
It's dang sure not going to break out a bone
No, absolutely not. And again, it's highly regulated. We only allow traps a certain size to be there on the landscape. And are there examples of extreme violations? Yes. But that's our job to ensure that we're out there catching those individuals and holding them accountable. And with that being said, we do need to make some adjustments in certain areas. And I think we're going to go forward and do that for sure if we can survive this legislative session and get the opportunity to do so.
Yeah. And I think one of those things is being suggested and is being tossed around, if I'm not mistaken, is kind of like the cougar, just a trapper identification type or an education type of course. And I think that would be very beneficial because I know... it's almost like shed hunting. When the prices go up, you get people who have never done it are looking, and Ty put it very, very plainly, if you're looking to make a quick buck off of trapping, it's not going to happen. Right. You're going to spend more doing it. But that's kind of what happens when those furs go up. Guys who don't normally trap kind of throw some traps out there and see what they can catch and get some money. Yeah, it's, like you said, it's highly regulated. It's really almost a non-issue.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, and your best trappers that are working on their equipment, they've got the best equipment, they're setting their pan tension right, they're trapping in locations, they don't want to catch non-target species. They dang sure don't want to catch people's pets. But do we have some individuals that trap too close to town? Yes. And we try to address that, and we try to educate. So I think trapper education is going to be a fantastic tool. A lot of our violations that seem egregious like that, where we're catching pets and other things, it's often new trappers that are doing just that. They're hearing about the price of pelts and thinking it's a quick buck. And the reality is, if you don't know what you're doing, the odds of you making any money are slim to none. But yeah, we'll continue watching that one for sure.
So here's a good question for you, just off the top of my mind. We do a lot in educating the sportsmen. We do a lot. We talk a lot about, you know, trapper education, then the cougar identification type of stuff. Does the department have any vested interest, or is there any programs on the other side of things to just educate general public about these are accepted and regulated and viable practices for managing wildlife?
Mm-hmm.
And also, is there things that sportsmen can do to help with that?
Right. Well, are you talking trapping specific?
No, just in general, hunting, trapping, etc.
Yes, I think the department is very much interested in promoting more education to the public, the general public, not just our sportsmen. And that's one thing in field operations that we're currently working on, is getting our officers out there amongst their public, which oftentimes is going to be our sportsmen that want to put forth the effort to go talk to the game warden. But just to go discuss with their public on what would they like to see the game department do. What are we doing good at? You know, what do they appreciate? What would they like to see us do better at? And really get it from the ground up, where our officers can come to us at headquarters and say, here's what my segment, my community would like to see. And again, it does not mean that that's going to occur, because we got to do it at the landscape scale of the whole state. But trying to get the voice of the masses in there, into our management, and not just being heard at a game commission meeting.
Yeah. Do we have any other questions that we had from just?
I don't think so. I think that's you got the last one there, right?
Yes, I have the last one. I guess before we ask that question, Colonel, is there anything that you would like to kind of put out there for our listeners on, I guess, understanding about how the department works, what the position of the officers and field ops is within that, and the relationship between the public and those officers, mm-hmm. going forward?
Well, you know, ultimately our officers are out there to enforce the laws and rules to protect the resource. But a significant portion is education and community policing, building relationships with our community. And the biggest thing I want out there is that our sportsmen and our officers and our general public, we're all on the same side of wanting to protect the resource and love of the resource. As politics get into the mix, it's ever more important that we recognize that we're on the same side and come together and to try and continue to keep this heritage of our hunting, fishing, and trapping alive in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a segment out there that, even though it might be just right now focusing on trapping, there's a segment out there that wants to do away with the use of our wildlife entirely. Mm-hmm. They do not want any hunting, fishing, or trapping. None. And we saw that with, or we're seeing that with this trapping bill, that we would be the first state to ban all trapping on public land, to include cage traps that are a danger to nothing. We need to recognize that. And right behind trapping, I assure you, if they were to accomplish that, the next thing is going to be hound hunting. Or lion hunting, or bear hunting in general. It's a progressive thing that we've seen across the nation.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Yes.
And it is a fear among, you know, many hunters, if not a conspiracy theory, an actual fear that's what this trapping bill is. It's just a step in the direction of getting rid of hunting, because if you use predators to control big game populations, why do we need to hunt?
Right.
And unfortunately, that's been one of the hunters' arguments for hunting for years, is that we need to manage populations. Well, if they take that argument away, then we don't need hunters, because we have predator population.
And it's not an unfounded fear, because that's not what they are trying to do. They're trying to take that step. Again, that comes back to the education, and we as sportsmen, along with the Game and Fish, along with your local officer, need to be willing to step up. And if you obviously there's people out there you're not going to be able to reason with, but there are people, there's the vast majority of people out there, like your neighbors, who may not hunt but don't have anything against hunting. They're hearing this misinformation. Correct. Really, all it takes to correct that is for you to step and say, that's not exactly true.
Sure.
There's a lot more to wildlife management, than just allowing predators to control the prey populations. If you know anything about wildlife management, that's a very violent process.
Yes.
The boom and bust cycles of nature.
But it's important, as we do need our sportsmen to get out there and educate as many people as possible. But they need to do it properly and take the emotion out of it.
Correct.
Everyone's got their point of view.
Uh-huh.
And take the emotion out of it. Don't get in arguments. Explain the facts. Learn the facts. And explain it. And some you will change, others you won't. But as sportsmen in general, what we need to all be cognizant of is that there is a segment out there that... there's a significant segment out there that they're not against hunting, fishing, or trapping. They just don't do it. There is the far extreme that they're absolutely against it. We probably will not affect those individuals.
Yeah.
But the majority...
No use arguing.
No.
Yeah. It's like wrestling a pig.
Yeah, but the majority out there, they might just be indifferent to it. They don't participate, but they may not even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But as sportsmen, what we can do is always show respect for our harvest. And whether it's elk hunting or deer hunting, if you're hunting in the southern end of the state and you kill a large animal that the rack sticks up above the bed of the pickup, congratulations. People are going to see it. But we don't need to put it in people's faces.
Yes.
If you've got your harvest and for some reason, and you see it all the time, that they lop the head off of something and they put it on the four-wheeler and it's looking out the back and they drive from Lordsburg to Santa Fe on the interstate.
Mm-hmm.
How many people are seeing that? Or that cow elk with her head draped over the side?
Yes.
How many people are you turning off? How many of that middle segment that were not against it, but now they're looking at that for 70 miles? Well, maybe now they are against it.
Yeah, it pushes them to the other side. How we conduct ourselves has a great effect on those people that are in the middle ground.
Yes.
And we don't want to be pushing them to the other side, because then they're going to become one more person that's against hunting.
Without a doubt.
So we've got to, and we've talked about that a lot, Kyle.
We've talked about all of this a lot. The education, educate yourself, don't be ignorant and just, spew off old wives' tales or do anything like that. Learn the facts. Be, you know, articulate whenever, you know, be able to explain those facts. At the same time, you know, don't, I guess, showboat is kind of a word we can use, but you still, you know, be a proud hunter. We don't mind you being that.
Without a doubt, do not be ashamed of being a hunter, but show respect for your harvest. Show respect for the other side of those individuals that are on the fence, but educate yourself when you get the opportunity to educate somebody, do so. Yes, jump on that opportunity.
All those are very important points. It's our way of life and we have to protect it.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess we can kind of wrap this up with a couple of things. I know you're a big hunter. Do you have any good hunting stories that kind of stick out to you over the years? And then we'll finish up with Curtis Seifert sent in a question about your any work situations. We'll start with the hunting stories because everybody likes hunting stories, and I'm sure you've got a few.
You know, I've got a lot of hunting stories. You know, I've had the opportunity to kill some pretty good species at times. I'm primarily an archery hunter.
Yeah. And actually, I think I'm going to narrow you down because, and this will kind of maybe flow into. Would you be able to tell that story about you and Ty hunting the archery hunt down in the southeast part of the state where you caught the guy shooting a rifle?
Yeah, it's you know, as a game warden, you really look forward, like any hunter, but especially as game warden, you look forward to those opportunities where you draw a tag and get to leave kind of work behind and go hunting.
Go be a normal guy.
Yeah, go be a normal guy. And we drew a tag down in the Sacramento, or not the Sacramento's, down in the Guadalupe's, and we were hunting deer. And both of us have harvested multiple deer over the years, and so we've gotten kind of particular to what we decide to actually put a stock on. And this particular deer hunt was pretty tough. We just weren't finding many trophy-sized mule deer. And a few days into it, we finally found a pretty good buck that was worth putting a good stock on. And we're pretty excited after several days of hunting that we found this buck. And we're up there on a hill glassing him. And when I say up on a hill, we're with a pickup.
Yeah.
Skyline, the whole nine yards, looking at this buck, and had just gotten done having the conversation of finally found one worthy of putting a stock on. He was pretty far out there. And as we're looking at him through the glass, the first rifle shot rings out. And again, this is an archery hunt. And we kind of both pick our head up and go, "You got to be kidding me." And then the second rifle shot rings out, and we can tell that buck is hit, and he kind of spins and runs off. And then third, fourth rifle shot. And so we start looking around, and pretty soon we see a pickup, half a mile away, up on a hill. And just couldn't believe ourselves that we're relaxed, we're away from the job, and here's a violation occurring right in front of us on a buck that's taken us 4 or 5 days to find. And we actually had another kid with us that his dad, he is now a game warden with us, but his dad was a retired sergeant with us, and he's jumping out of his skin, can't believe it. And so your brother and I were pretty upset at this point, and we tell that kid, "Well, get on the phone, see if you can get an officer over here." And he's like, "Well, what are y'all gonna do?" He's like, "Well, we're gonna catch this son of a gun." And both of us had our badges with us, and we built the game plan. It's like, "Well, let's go sack this guy up." And we drive over there, and obviously not in uniform, and we meet this guy on the hillside, and badge him, show him the badges, and so he was pretty shocked, to say the least, that out in the middle of nowhere, he decided to poach this mule deer in front of two game wardens.
It's almost like him stepping on that little two-inch trap.
Yeah, yeah, he stepped on the pan.
Well, I got caught.
And so we kind of sack him up and get a hold of the local officer there and have him sitting there on the ground. We already have his firearm, everything set aside, and just pretty much gift wrap this case for this officer. But I did tell that guy, I was like, man, of all the people in the state where you decided to do this, you did it in front of two office slug game wardens, because both of us were there in Santa Fe at the time. And we're caught by office guys, and not even
caught
field
by the guys running the desk.
Yeah,
not, the field guys.
Not even by field guys anymore. But so it was comical after the fact, but pretty dang frustrating to put that much effort into that hunt and finally find the buck we were willing to go after.
And you did recover the buck.
We ended up recovering the buck. He had hit him bad. He hit him twice, but that buck. He would have died, but we were able to track him down and finish him off. And that kid that was with us ended up putting him down with a bow and taking
him.
That's
good.
So,
I didn't know that.
But it was pretty comical, to say the least. Your brother and I have been hunting partners for a lot of years and have had some great hunts. As I've gotten older and my boys are hunting, that's what I enjoy more than anything now is watching them harvest. You know, I do hunt with a rifle some, but primarily with a bow, and it's about just those opportunities to be out there. And if I get to knock an arrow, it's a success. Whether I draw back and get to fire a shot or not, it's just being out there. So.
Yeah, that brings to mind kind of another interesting thought that I think most people probably don't realize is just how involved being a game warden is. You almost can't turn it off.
No, you can't. You know, just like any other law enforcement, we take an oath to enforce the laws and the Constitution, and you're out there. You can't turn it off. As much as you try. When I was stationed there in the Gila, you know, the premier elk hunting in the world. I actually drew a couple tags there, but it was not as relaxing to hunt where I was working because I couldn't turn it off. So I quit putting in the Gila just so I could go somewhere else and hunt and not have to worry about my local issues.
And that guy and knowing
probably
what he's up to and not be able to relax.
And them knowing me and my personal vehicle and worrying about, you know, if someone had let the air out of my tires or bust a window or you're hearing a rifle shot during archery season and wanting to go home and get in uniform and go handle that, it took the fun out of, or the relaxation out of the hunt.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I still love hunting as much as any, so.
Yeah, that's good. We'll end up with Curtis's question. He asked, what's the strangest work-related situation you found yourself in?
You know, I don't know. Being a game warden in the field especially, you run across so many stories. And early on, I had an uncle, you know, I'd always tell stories, some of the cases or situations you get in. He's like, man, you need to write those down. Those are hilarious. And I didn't, so I've forgotten a lot of them. But it's funny how people, the things that they decide to do really in public, but they think they're secluded, you know. I think every game warden's run across someone out there doing some deviant act with each other where they think is out in the middle of nowhere and it isn't. You know,
you better stop that stuff because game cameras are pretty prevalent nowadays.
You know, the plane crashes, the car crashes, the suicides, the bad side of law enforcement that you see. I've had to draw my weapon a few times that got pretty sketchy, but an interesting fact on that, I've had two different guns pulled on me, and they're both by females. That was kind of out of the ordinary.
Right?
So,
When you stop and think about it, it's not really that surprising, right?
Right. Right. But just a lot of good experiences, a lot of funny stuff. A lot of the funnier stories were actually scary at the time, and but you know, yeah. Again, you went home safe and you found the comedy in it. Just a lot of fun, and you meet a lot of good people. You're the only game warden in the area, so everyone remembers your face. You don't always remember theirs because you see so many people. But one instance in particular, I got to go on a department trip to Portland, Oregon, to go to Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation to run our booth. And me and a biologist are sitting there, and these two guys walk up. And instantly, I can tell they're giving me the cold shoulder, just focusing on the biologist and not even saying hello to me. And after I've tried to engage with them, obviously turning their back to me and wanting to focus on this other guy. And I was like, do I know you guys? And they're like, yeah, you don't remember us? I was like, I promise you I don't. I mean, I'm not from Oregon. And they said, you wrote us a citation. And I had written them a citation a few years earlier in New Mexico, run into them in Portland, Oregon. I don't even remember what the citation was, but they dang sure remembered me.
Yeah, that's pretty personal for them.
Yeah, yeah. But greatest job in the world. Wouldn't change it for anything. I've got, one of my oldest son is actually talking about potentially wanting to be a game warden. My younger, he wants to be an engineer, so maybe he can support our hunting habit. So,
well, very good. Colonel, really appreciate you joining us. I think you give some very valuable insights into the goings on in the game and fish, and kind of you do a very good, every time I've spoken to you, you do a very good job of articulating how important the game warden's job is, and I think you've done a fantastic job of presenting that professional face to the public from the department, and I sure appreciate that. So.
Yeah, and thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys. It's good that we have shows like this that are promoting our heritage. So that's essential.
Very good. All right, guys, join us next time.
Adios.
Adios.
Thanks for joining Nada Grande Outdoors Podcast.
Come follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. And don't forget about our website, www.nadagrandeoutdoors.com.
Adios.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.